العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا أبا القاسم محمد صلى الله على محمد وعلى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. Assalamu alaikum, brothers and sisters. It's an honor to be here in front of y'all. It's difficult speaking with no one in the middle there. If some people could sit in the middle, it'd be good. Inshallah, I'm going to continue the speech that I gave from last week. Last week I was talking about one of the sermons of Najwa Balagha, sermon 192, which is called Al-Qasi'. And I'm going to be continuing this throughout, you know, a number of Fridays, inshallah. Of course, next Friday and the Friday after that, there's special occasions, so I'll be taking a break, but inshallah, from the Friday after that, we'll start up again. That's one thing. Another announcement, after the speech, we're going to have a question and answer session for about 15 minutes or so, and if there's more questions, we'll do it for longer. And so think of your questions. Your questions could be about the speech itself or any other question that you have. And if I have the answer, I'll give it to you, inshallah. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Also, as I said last week, and I say all the time, I need loud salawats. This today more than ever, because I'm feeling a little sick, so this will give me, you know, energy so I can forget my sickness, inshallah. Now, last speech, we talked a little bit about the first sentence of the sermon. And it was we mentioned a couple of the attributes of Allah, Izzah and Kibriya. Now we're going to go on to one of the next statements. And it says in Arabic, ثُمَّ اخْتَبْرَ الْمَلَائِكَ الْمُقَرَّبِينَ لِيُمَيِّزَ الْمُتَوَضِّئِينَ مِنْهُمْ مِنَ الْمُتَكَبِّرِينَ الْمُسْتَكْبِرِينَ Sorry, thank you. He says this, Imam Ali alayhi salam. Then he put his angels on trial concerning these attributes in order to distinguish those who are modest from those who are arrogant. So he's saying that he's put the angels to a test. Now, one of the things that this test here, I want to concentrate on the test for a little bit. If we look in all of the religions, if we look in Islam, Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, Buddhism, every religion you could think of, this world that we're in right now is considered a test. It's not considered the goal. There's something else that's coming from here. In Islam, it depends what we do here. We're tested on in this world. If we do good, inshallah, we'll go to heaven. If we do bad, a'udhu billah, we'll go to hell. There's a test here. Christianity, the same thing, there's a test. In Christianity, it's more about your belief than your actions. In Judaism, there's a test. Even in religions that believe in reincarnation, they state that if you do good in this life, in the next life, you'll be born into a rich family. You'll have a better, life. If you do bad in this life, in the next world, you'll be some animal, or you'll be born into poverty or something. So every single religion that you look at, they consider this world as a test. And this actually, this world being a divine examination, is one of an item which we call divine sunnahs. There's these divine sunnahs that rule the universe. Now, I don't know if you've heard that term before, but it's used in the Quran. There's many different divine sunnahs that we have. So this is something that's important. Now, what are divine sunnahs? Divine sunnahs are laws which are unchangeable. Laws which apply to everybody, every human being on earth. Laws which apply in all times, from the beginning of the creation to the day of judgment. These are divine sunnahs. Ayatollah Mukarram Shirazi, he defined divine sunnahs. He said that a divine sunnah is a established or fundamental law, which is either a natural law or a legislated law, and it cannot change. It's firm, it's established, it will not change. Now, it's important to learn these divine sunnahs, these laws, so we could get a bearing of where we are. We could figure out, you know, how the universe works. And when we recognize it, then we could try to move forward. We could use this knowledge, this of these divine students that we have, to try to figure out how we could move forward and move closer to Allah, inshallah. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Now, before I get into the divine sunnah of this divine examination, I'm going to mention a couple other divine sunnahs so you could get the gist of what I'm talking about. One of the divine sunnahs I'm going to mention is the relationship between between internal and external changes. That first we have to change ourselves before we see a change on the outside. And there's a verse of Quran which states, "Inna la la yughiru ma bi qawmin hatta yughiru ma bi anfusihim." It states, "Indeed, Allah does not change a people's lot, a people's conditions, until they change what is in their souls." Now, what's this telling us? This is telling us that our destiny is in our own hands. That if we want to change our conditions, if we're upset about the conditions that we're living in, if we want something better for ourselves, for our community, for our religion, for whatever it may be, it's up to us. We can't just sit there and wait for something to come. We have to change ourselves first. We have to think about changing ourselves. Now, all of us right now, we're living in a very terrible time. And there's many reasons why this time is terrible. But the main reason is because we're living in a period which is called the occultation, where our imam is not present. Our imam is hidden. This is something we should all be muntadhirin. We should all be awaiting, longing for his advent, for his return. And it's funny because they say all that he needs to come back is 313 people to be self-purified. 313 people to be, you know, where they should be. But that's not the case. If we want him to come back, we have to work on ourselves. If we want the Imam to come back, we have to change what's inside our souls. Now there's a story, because some people, whenever you know, you mention this number, 313, you always, you know, at least I think, and I'm sure other people think, you know, there's 313 religious people in this world. Right now in this masjid, there's a number of people. In Sydney, you know, I'm sure there's a large number of people who we consider religious. In Iran, in Lebanon, in the Middle East, you have, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands. You see, the masjids that I live in Iran, the masjids are full. Itikaf, we had a few sisters here do itikaf, alhamdulillah. In Iran, in Qom, which is a small city, you have huge masjids filled where people want to do itikaf, but there's no room for them. But they're still not the 313 people. There's a story I wanted to mention, or I wanted to relate to you. There's two versions of it. One of it happens in Hilla, which is in Iraq, and one in Isfahan. So I'll mention the one in Isfahan, where people say that, you know, there has to be 313 people. It's impossible that there's not. But this shows you, this story will show you how there's still room for us to work on. Even if we think that there's enough people, there's not. Because if there was, he would definitely come back. Now, there was a famous speaker in Isfahan who would go on the minbar, he'd give speeches, he was a scholar. And he would always speak about Imam Zaman. This was his topic of choice, always. At one time in one of his speeches, he said, you know, I'm in this masjid, whatever masjid it was. In this masjid, there's 1,000 people. Out of these 1,000 people, there's definitely 313 of you are mu'mineen, are where you should be. So I don't understand how it could be that Imam Zaman needs 313 people and he hasn't, and until then he hasn't come back. I don't get that. Because there has to be this amount of people. Does this ever come across your mind? Because sometimes I think about this. I'm sure you guys think about this from time to time as well. So the story goes like this. It says that he went home, and it was at night, Imam Zaman came to his house. He knocked on the door, and he said, "So you think there's 313 people here, right? Look at all those people in the mosque. Go and invite the most religious people you can find. The most religious. Invite them to come to the house tomorrow. And I'll be in there." Some Iranian houses, they have a way to go up to the second story from the courtyard. So imagine there's like a room on the second story. On the courtyard, there's stairs that lead up to this room. He says, "I'll be in this room when they come." So the next day, he invited a large, 1,000 people, let's say, or however many people, a large amount of people. They came to the courtyard. And he said, "Imam Zaman is upstairs," right? So then Imam Zaman says, "Send the first person up." The first person goes up the stairs, opens the door, closes the door. You hear a loud scream. And then you see blood flowing down the stairs. Right? So people in the courtyard are like, "Okay, what's going on?" Then Imam Zaman says, "Send the second one up." Second person comes up the stairs. Again, a loud scream. Blood starts falling down the stairs. Now people are starting to leave. By the time Imam Zaman tells the third person to come up, the same thing happens. Everyone else left. Everyone said, I'm not going to go up those stairs and get killed. Then the owner of the house, the speaker, he went up the stairs, and he saw that the three people were sitting in the corner of the room, and there were three dead sheep next to the door. So he would tell the people, "Scream," and he would slaughter the sheep, and the blood would go down the stairs. And he says, "You see, there's not even four people who are willing to walk upstairs, let alone 313 people who will give their lives for me." Now, if this story is 100% true or not, I can't, vouch for it 100%, but it's a famous story that I've heard. So back to the divine exam, or the internal and external change, which is one of the divine sunnahs. This is something that we have to be serious. If we want to change the situation we're in, we have to change ourselves. We have to work on ourselves. We have to do whatever we can to make ourselves better Muslims, better Shia. We have to do this. It's very important. If we call ourselves Muntadhirin, if we are seriously awaiting and longing for his return, this is a daily struggle that we should have, trying to change ourselves. صلوات على محمد وعلى محمد. Now let me go on to a second divine sunnah. Another divine sunnah is victory will be given to the believers in this world and the next. The believers will be victorious. This is a divine sunnah. This is something that Allah promises. Right? Even if we don't see it right now, it is something that will happen in the future. There's many verses in the Quran that mention this. And what's it called? I could make, a whole speech just about this one divine sunnah. But because it's not, I'm only going to mention one verse, and then we're going to get into the subject of this speech, which is divine examination. Now, the one verse I'll recite is this. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. وَقُلْ جَاءَ الْحَقِّ وَزَهَقَ الْبَاطِلِ إِنَّ الْبَاطِلَ كَانَ زُهُوكًا. The truth has come, and falsehood has vanished. Verily, falsehood is bound to vanish. It vanishes. And a lot of people interpret this verse to mean that when the truth comes, or when whatever the truth is, falsehood cannot stand up. So truth will be victorious. Now this divine sunnah is conditioned. There's some divine sunnahs which are not conditioned, and there's some that are conditioned. So this one here, the ulama have stated that there's three conditions for it. The first condition is faith, belief. We have to have correct faith. We have to have correct theological beliefs. This is imperative. If we believe, we'll set one of the conditions. But if we don't have correct faith, we're not going to be victorious. So first, that tells us what? That tells us that we have to study our religion. We have to know what we believe in. It's not that, okay, I'm Shia and that's it. No. We have to go out and we have to search and we have to figure out exactly what it is we're supposed to believe in and then think about it and try to incorporate it in our beliefs. Something that's very important. Spirituality and knowledge go hand in hand. Right? You can't get so high spiritually until your knowledge couples it. They go up together. If you have so much knowledge without spirituality, you're not going to get anywhere. If you have a lot of spirituality without a lot of knowledge, you're also not going to get anywhere. You need both. Now, we're having classes on Monday nights, a theological class about theology, which I encourage all of you to come. And inshallah, in these classes, we'll learn more about our religion and more about the beliefs that we have. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. The second condition for this victory, this divine victory, is that we have to help Allah. Now, what does it mean, help Allah? Allah does not need anything. Allah is not needy. When we help someone, it's usually because they need something from us and we're able to provide that, so we're helping them. If they need money, we're able to give them money. If they need a ride somewhere, we're able to give them a ride. If they need our help in studying something, we could help them studying something. They have some deficiency which we're able to make up for. We're able to help them with. But when we think about it with Allah, Allah does not need anything. Allah does not have any deficiency. He's absolute perfection. So how can we help absolute perfection? When we are, you know, we're weak and we have nothing to give to Allah, what could we do? So the ulama explained this, and they said when it says help Allah, it means three things. It means one, helping his religion. So for instance, attending the majalis. For instance, spreading Islam, teaching people about Islam, helping in the mosque, doing things like this, helping his religion. Second is helping his servants. So the believers who are in need, we help them. If there's a believer who needs money and we have it, we give it to him. If there's a believer who needs our help, you know, in teaching, our help in whatever it may be, if we have the ability to do this, we do this. And this is helping Allah. The third one is helping the oppressed, whoever they are and wherever they are, if they're Muslim or not. If there are people who are oppressed in this world, we help them. We stand up for them. We support them. And this is helping Allah. Because Allah is one who helps the oppressed, and we try to take that on as well. Now I remember a few years back, there was a brother who came to Qom from Colombia, which is in South America. And he was telling me that you know, one of the things that this brother did is he helped spread Islam to oppressed people. And it had huge effects. He would, you know, tell me stories about, you know, what he did. And basically what he did, you know, Colombia is a country, the economy is not very strong. So there's many villages inside Colombia who are, you know, living terrible. And he said that he would go to these villages where the parents of these villages would walk for miles or kilometers to sell sticks of gum to make money to bring back to feed their family. Right, and this was how they made money. So of course they didn't make much money. And he said, like in a family of five or six people, two people would have dinner, the rest wouldn't. And then the next day, two of the other people would have. The next day, very poor. So what would this brother do? He said, what I would do is I'd collect a few hundred dollars, not even $1,000, a few hundred dollars. And I would go into the village, I would set up a school. And in the school, I would teach the kids regular secular studies, and I would provide lunch for them. So their parents, you know, would love to send them and would see that, oh, you know, this person's taking care of us. He's giving us food. It's something that's very important for them. And then after a couple weeks, I would let them know that I'm Muslim. And I would teach them about their religion. And he'd say, within a month, this entire village would become Muslim. So we get happy when we when one person converts to Islam. This person converts villages to Islam. And then they would all convert to Islam. He would send one of his friends to take care of the school, and then he'd move on to the next village. And this is what he did. This is his life, going village to village, converting them to Islam. So when we stand up for the oppressed, when we do something to help the oppressed, we're actually spreading Islam, because eventually they'll figure out that we're Muslim, and they'll realize that it was Muslims who stood up for us. And that's something that's really big. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. The third condition for this victory is unity. Unity is something that, you know, I've gotten into a few conversations actually over the last couple of weeks that I've been here about this subject. And it's something that I see is kind of misinterpreted. Okay? Unity, first of all, what does unity mean? When I'm saying we should unify, I'm not saying we should compromise our beliefs. Our beliefs are on the table, and we will not compromise the smallest belief that we have. Everything that we believe in, we stand up for and we defend. But does that mean we can't work with anybody else? Does that mean that we cannot stand next to another, you know, our Sunni brothers, for instance? Like, imagine if our goal was to feed the homeless. In America, we have homeless people. I don't know if we have them here. But imagine that what we wanted to do is we wanted to feed the homeless. Can we not stand next to our Sunni brothers and feed the homeless together? Is that something that we can't do? If we do it, we'd be more successful in doing it. And there's other examples you could give which would be even more stronger. But unity is not compromise, but it's working together for a common goal. And we could do this. We could do this with Sunnis. We could do this with Christians. In this community, you've worked with Christians before. So unity is something that's tangible, but it doesn't mean compromise. And this unity is also the third condition to victory. If we're not if the believers are not unified, we're not going to be victorious. So there's three conditions. One was faith, one was helping Allah, and one was unity. Now these were examples of divine sunnahs. I want to come back to the subject of this speech, which is the divine sunnah of examination, that we're always in a constant test. We're always being tested by Allah. Now what does it mean we're being tested by Allah? What does that mean? Does that mean that Allah does not know what's going to happen? That Allah is putting a test in front of us to see if we pass or fail, and then he could decide afterwards what to do with us? Is that what happens? Or is Allah's knowledge perfect and complete? One thing is, Allah is immaterial. He's not bound by time or space. So that means his knowledge of the past, his knowledge of the present, and his knowledge of the future all happens at the same time, which is difficult for us who are material beings to grasp. But there's no future and there's no past for Allah. Right now, it's 1,000 years ago, it's the present, and it's 1,000 years from now, at this moment for Allah. There's no time. There's no time constraints. So that being said, he knows if we're going to pass the test or not. He knows if Allah, if you know, whatever difficulty is put in our way, he knows our reaction to it, because it's already happened in his eyes. Does that mean we're forced? Does that mean we don't have choice? Because Allah knows what's going to happen, does that mean we don't have any choice in the matter? We're forced to pass or fail? No. Allah has given us free will. So we have this free will, we're able to decide to do the right thing or the wrong thing. We're able to decide to obey Allah or to disobey Allah. And him knowing what we're going to do does not affect the choice that he's given us. If you could understand that. Now, let's take a teacher, for instance. Before I went to the Hausa, I was a teacher at a Muslim school in Los Angeles. I taught English. And some of the students were very good students. I knew that when I give them the test, they're definitely going to pass. No doubt about it. Some of the students, unfortunately, weren't so good. And I knew that no matter how easy I made the test, there's no way that these students would pass. No way. I knew it. Now, does that mean that I don't have to give a test? Does that mean that I could say, okay, these students passed and these students failed just because I know that will happen? No, I have to give them the opportunity to show themselves. I have to give them the opportunity to pass or fail. So this is what Allah is doing. He knows the outcome, but He still has to give us this opportunity to get closer to Allah, to pass this test, or to fail. Okay, so if there's questions on this, inshallah, afterwards, we could go into it further, inshallah. Now, there's a couple of verses of the Quran which I want to show where Allah says that He tests us, that there's an examination here. The first one, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, الَّذِي خَلَقَ الْمَوْتَ وَالْحَيَاةَ لِيَبْلُوكُمْ أَيُّكُمْ أَحْسَنَ عَمَلًا وَهُوَ الْعَزِيزُ الْغَفُورُ. He created death and life that He may test you, that He may test you to see which one of you is best in conduct. And He is the Almighty, the All-Forgiving. Azizul Ghafur. When I was in Qom, I took a tafsir class. And the teacher, he was a very good teacher. This teacher said always, whenever you come across a verse of Quran where it has these two attributes at the end, any two attributes, always try to think of what relationship these two attributes have with the verse. Very important. Always, whenever you come across those verses and they end in two attributes, Ar-Rahman, Ar-Rahim, Aliyul Adhim, they're all over the Quran. Think about what relationship those attributes have to the actual verse itself. So in this verse, he's saying Allah created death and life that He may test you, so He could see which of you is best in conduct. Then it's saying He's the Almighty and the All-Forgiving. So what does that mean? The All-Forgiving is clear. It means, okay, if we're being tested, if we try but fail, Allah is the forgiving. He'll forgive us. So if we put forth sincere effort and try our best, and sometimes we'll make mistakes, in this case, Allah will forgive us. But the Almighty, what does that have to do? Maybe what He's saying there, maybe, is that if someone does not care at all, dismisses the fact that he's being tested, I don't care. I'm going to do whatever I want. I'm going to react however I want. I don't care what Allah thinks. In this case, Allah is the Almighty. In this case, you have to watch out. Allah is showing His power here. It's a possibility. But this is something that we should do. We're always asked in the Quran itself to ponder over the verses of Quran, to think about the verses of Quran. And this is one way we could do it. When the two attributes come, we should think about how they relate to the verse itself. But we should always know our place, because our thoughts and imaginations about what the verses mean, we cannot take that as being true Islamic knowledge. We have to get our Islamic knowledge from the scholars, but we also have to think. So we could think, we could ponder, but when we're saying, you know, what Islam actually says, we have to go to the scholars. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Now, how are we tested? What is the method of this test? How does Allah test us? Some people, they say that we're tested only by difficulty. When some difficulty hits our life, the loss of a loved one. For instance, there's one brother I talked to a year ago, I think, and he was telling me about his daughter. He lost his daughter. His daughter was in a park, and she was kidnapped and killed. And her body was found, you know, a couple weeks later, you know, somewhere in the park. A Muslim sister, she wore hijab and everything. It was very tough on this brother and on the community. This is one test. This is one huge test to see, does this brother have patience? Will he turn away from Islam? What's his reaction going to be? That's one of the hardest things you could imagine. There's other difficulties, poverty, for instance. For instance, there's one brother that I know. He's a Mu'min, very religious. I know him personally, very religious. And unfortunately, he's in a very difficult financial state right now. He was in prison for like 25 years or something. He got out of prison, can't find a job. Now he can't find a job, he keeps getting kicked out, and maybe even in a few days he's going to be homeless. But Allah is testing him. Allah is testing him. He's testing the community. How are we going to react to this? How are Muslims going to treat this brother? Are they going to help him or not? That's one thing. They're also testing him. What is he going to do in this time of difficulty? Is he going to resort to breaking Allah's commands? Or is he going to stay strong in faith? So we could always be tested with difficulty. But is that the only way Allah tests us? Does he only test us with these difficult things that happen to every single one of us? All of us, we see difficulties in our lives. We face difficulties. But that's not it. This is not the only way that Allah tests us. He tests us through good things as well. There's a verse of Quran. كُلُّ نَفْسٍ ذَاهِقَةُ الْمَوْتِ. Every soul will taste death. وَنُبْلُوكُمْ بِشَارْ وَخَيْرِ. And you're tested with evil and good. So not only are we tested with difficulty, we're tested with goodness as well. Wealth, money. Some of us, Allah gives us, Allah opens the door and gives us a lot of risk. We become wealthy. This is something that's positive. But we're tested. What are we going to do with this wealth? Are we going to use it to be extravagant? Are we going to use it to show off, to become arrogant, to think that we're better than others? Or are we going to use it to secure our lives and our families' lives and also help the cause of Islam? Are we going to, when there's a Muslim brother in need and we have the means to help him, are we going to help him or not? We're tested with this wealth, with position and power. Some of us have position in the masjid. Some of us have a position in a business. We're tested with this as well. What do we do with this position? Do we use it to become arrogant? Do we use it to help ourselves? Or do we use it to help the cause of Islam? What do we do with this power that Allah has given us? Knowledge. Allah gives us knowledge. Some of us know a lot about the religion. What do we do with this? Do we teach others? Or do we just keep it to ourselves? We have knowledge about things that are other than, we have knowledge about secular things as well. What do we do with this knowledge? Do we use it to help Islam or not? So we're faced, we're tested with both good and bad. Every situation we're in, everything we're given, everything that's taken away from us, everything is a test. And the more we keep that in mind, the more that we keep that this world is not the goal. The goal is the hereafter. How we will be placed in the hereafter depends on what we do here, how we react to these tests that we're seeing. The more we keep that in mind, the easier it will be to pass the test. If we forget about that, if we're oblivious of this fact, it's going to be difficult to pass the test. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Now, in the last part of this speech, I wanted to mention a subject that's a little bit off this topic of divine examination, but it has to do with the phrase itself. And again, it's mentioning arrogance. Right? It said to see, what's it called? It said, Imam Ali alayhi salam, he said, then he put his angels on trying concerning these attributes in order to distinguish those who are modest, who are humble, from those who are arrogant. Right? So here, as in the last week, this humbleness and this arrogance comes into play. Now, we're taught that arrogance is a negative quality and humility is a positive quality. But is this always the case? Is it always positive to be humble? Is it always negative to be arrogant? This is something we have to think about. Humility is humility. Being humble is only positive when we're humble in front of Allah. Allah is the one we should be humble in front of. We should not show humility to anyone other than Allah. This is something that should be clear. If we humble ourselves in front of the creation, this is not considered positive. It's only considered positive when we humble ourselves in front of the Creator. Now there's this, when I was going over these notes, I remembered a story. That same brother who was in prison for 25 years and is now in serious need right now, I remember a story of him. In the prison he was in, there were Sunnis and Shias. And the Sunnis and Shias, they were not unified, so they were two different groups. Now there was one person in this prison, there was a criminal, a bad person. And he was huge, a very big person. He was about, I have to convert pounds to kilograms. He was like almost 2 meters tall and 180 kilograms, 400 pounds. Huge person. And all muscle as well. He played football, American football. Now, what's it called? This person, he was in prison for rape, which is very bad. I think he raped like 17 people or something like that. And inside the prison, he wasn't any better than he was outside the prison. So inside the prison, he would rob people, he would steal things from people, he would commit, he would do all kinds of bad things. And one time, he went to what they call the assistant imam, the second in charge of the Sunnis. And he basically choked him out and stole his like beans or whatever he had. And the Muslims, the Sunni Muslims were upset, right? But they didn't do anything about it. They humbled themselves in front of this person because they were scared of him. Because they said, if we start a fight with this guy, he's going to kill us. He's huge. There's nothing we could do. So their leader went up to him and bowed down in front of him and said, look, I know, the second in charge must have done something wrong and we're sorry. Is there any way we could, make the situation better and like this? Where this brother, his name is Abdullah. Abdullah was Shia. He was the head of the Shias, and there was only a few Shias there. He's also very small. He's short and he's small. He's not a big person at all. He's a very small person. And he went up to this person, right? His name was Big Pretty, this guy. He went up to this person and he pointed in his face and he said, if you ever dare to touch a Shia, I'll fight you to the end and I'll never allow you to come close to any Shia. And the guy's looking down at him like, who is this little ant talking to me? Get out of here. But he didn't humble himself. This wasn't a time where you humble yourself. You only humble yourself in front of Allah. Now the other characteristic, arrogance, this other trait. When is it good for us to be arrogant? There is a time actually, but I'm not going to talk about it today. There is a time where we are supposed to be arrogant. But normally we're not. We're only supposed to be arrogant against oppressors, against those who are arrogant against us. But I'm going to leave that to another discussion. But the only one who has the right to be arrogant always is Allah. Because He is truly bigger and better and more powerful than everything else in creation. Everything else is weak. Everything else is insignificant. Everything else does not matter at all. The only thing that matters is Allah. So He has a right to be arrogant, to show himself off. And he does show off. Allah shows off. He created the universe, showed off his power. He sent revelation, he showed off his knowledge. Allah shows off because he can, because he's the arrogant. One of his attributes is arrogance, mutakabbir. But we don't have that right because we're not in his position. Allah is the one that can do this, not us. So, in this speech, before we open it up for question and answers, just a quick little recap. We went over divine sunnahs. I mentioned a couple of them. And I mentioned about the divine sunnah of examination. And we went into detail with that. And then I talked a little bit about humility and arrogance. Inshallah, in the next session, in the next lecture, which will be in 3 weeks' time, because next week is going to be Eid al-Mab'ath. We'll have a special lecture. Next week after that is going to be the birthday of Imam Hussein, I think, alayhi salam. And then after that, we'll continue our discussion of this sermon. But inshallah, after that, we'll get into the next phrase. So what you guys could do is you could go pick up the Najwa Balagha that's in your shelves that I don't know how much you read, and you could open it and open it up into this sermon. Inshallah, read on a little bit. So think about it. So the next time we talk about it, you'll have a little background, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.